E1, number 16A.
Now, Erie, see now first how things appear. Say, if we would take the attitude of looking out from the synonymous terms and being aware of ourselves as mind, which says, I'm mind, and therefore I'm not mortal mind. I'm not the mind of my own. And as mind, we could see that it expresses itself divinely as intelligence. That's the objective manifestation, how it expresses itself divinely. But then we can ask ourselves here on the level of Christian Science, we have to see how that affects the human and the erroneous. So we can go over here to the next categories of the human standpoint and ask ourselves, how does that divine consciousness, which we have taken as mind with its infinite intelligence, how does that mind affect the human standpoint? Now we begin to see that at this level we constantly take into consideration both standpoints. That's for the first time. In the higher levels, we always said we stick to the standpoint of the synonymous terms. But now we are at the level of Christian Science where we say, now we have to see what impact such a consciousness has on the human consciousness. How far the human consciousness is affected by it and how far it is changed by it or reformed by it. And so we can see and ask ourselves now what happens to the human consciousness, first objectively and second really subjectively. So we ask ourselves, you see, what happens to us? See, now that's the practicality of it. What happens to the human approach or to the human attitude when we entertain that divine consciousness of mind, which is always the all-intelligence mind, the all-knowing mind? And therefore we can see that if we entertain that consciousness, that something happens to our consciousness. Namely, that it does something to the human by bringing to the human, say, wisdom. That intelligence comes to the human and brings to us enlightenment. See, that we cannot, that's the beauty now here, that it shows that we cannot just stay with the divinely subjective consciousness and see that mind is the one mind, that mind knows itself, is all-knowing, is the intelligence of mind, is that which comprehends and apprehends and sees and hears everything, that it can see right through everything. That's the objective sense of intelligence. That cannot go on without that our human attitude is affected by it. It just hits the human consciousness and appears objectively, without that we are aware, suddenly as the breaking in of light, as an enlightenment, we can call it wisdom. Just to have one term for many terms, really. So, the objective sense, you see, is what? Is to show how the divine comes to us, how it hits us. Huh? If you are not too familiar with the difference between objective sense and the subjective sense, perhaps you can put instead of objective here, you can put in brackets how it comes to us, huh? How it hits us. So it is objective, so it is from outside, huh? Not from inside, from the humanly subjective sense. How from outside, so to say, we are hit by the divine consciousness. And so it comes to us, say, as wisdom, and it just hits us, and suddenly we see something clearer, suddenly the light breaks, suddenly we have an intuition. Can you see all these things? An intuition has not been thought out by us humanly, therefore cannot be humanly subjective. An intuition is something that comes, that perhaps comes in a dream, perhaps that comes when you are awakening in the morning, perhaps that comes through association of thought when you see something and it makes an association of thought. It's something that we are not thinking out subjectively. It's an objective happening. If this wisdom comes to us as vision, as enlightenment, as the sudden breaking in of a new idea, whatever we call it, then we are confronted with a decision. Namely, and this is the humanly subjective state, namely, are we going to take it in subjectively, or are we going to turn our back to it? Therefore, this subjective sense here is a great decision point where we say, am I going to take the new idea in and make it my own? Therefore, am I going now to turn to God? See, we have come really from the divinely right over to the humanly. We have made that transition from the divine consciousness and have been seeing that that does something to my human consciousness in an objective way. The objective comes to us as a vision. And then we can say, yes, I take it in, and therefore I'm thinking about it. I turn to that vision. I begin to value that vision. Or I can say, this is nonsense, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Then we don't make it subjective, and therefore we lose the divine impact. So when we are wise, we really do what? We really take it in, and that taking in, we say, we turn to God. We seek God. Now we do something, you see? So it can come to us as seeking, or we begin to seek, seeking God. See, all these subjective aspects are all turned towards the word, back, towards that first column. It says, all right, I have seen something, and now I have to take it in, and what I can do is that I am going to think about it, and seek it, and search it, and investigate it, and research it. Can you hear the tone of mind that is now directed to mind? That whole column of the humanly subjective is always directed to the word. Think about that. Not to the Christ, not to Christianity, not to man, not to science, but only to the statement of what God is. Therefore we have a sense of seeking God, of listening to God, of turning to God, of occupying our thoughts with God, researching it, Can you see that? And naturally, as we do that, as we seek God and don't reject the nature of God, therefore we get rid of what? Of ignorance about God. So it destroys within us through that seeking of God. It begins to destroy ignorance. Ignorance about God, huh? Not ignorance about anything. Ignorance about God. That's the most important thing. Can you see the flow? Now I come back to what I said at the beginning of this hour, where I was talking about categories and the various categories, and you were looking at me and thinking, oh, what is he saying actually, huh? So I can restate it, and now it begins to be quite clear. We can just look at these things again and say, the main thing is, always, I said, to ask the right question. You know, people ask thousands of questions. And that's the trouble with them. That's why their mind is so much occupied with nothing, with irrelevant things. One can see that they ask questions and questions and questions, and their mind is full of questions. This is not science. They think that's science if you ask questions, because science has to do with truth and therefore with explaining everything. But that's not science, that's an encyclopedia. We can have an encyclopedic knowledge, but that is not science. And in an encyclopedia you can look up everything. But science has to do with categorical thinking. To have categories in our thinking, and therefore only think in few, simple, straightforward, clear-cut categories. That's the thing which we have. But in order to do that, we really must be able to ask, what are the right categories? And this is the greatest achievement, if we can, like here, and I hope I have more or less found it, to ask the right categories. Namely, it's the point of intersection of the word in Christian Science. The word means statement of the nature of God. So everything which we have here in those six categories must be somehow related to the statement of the nature of God, and not to the nature of the Christ. And not to the nature of Christianity or man, not to the nature of science, must only be directed to the nature of the Word of God, the nature of God. Then we said, all right, that's the Word. And in Christian Science, that statement of the nature of God must be seen in the relationship of the divine to the human. Here you have the divine and then the human. And it must be in the relationship of truth to error. Here we have the truth, the divine statement, and we have error right at the end here in the last column. We have the error. Huh? What it annihilates, naturally, that it annihilates error. Huh? The erroneous concept of God, really, huh? We should say, annihilates wrong concept of God, perhaps we could put in. Yeah. So we have a scene already, the necessity of having these categories. Then, the most important point then is to see if there is a relationship between the divine and the human. That relationship can only be possible over the bridge of subjectivity, which is true objective. of a subjectivity, of a consciousness which is engaged in a true objective manifestation of the nature of God. So that, therefore, can you see, we ended the divine standpoint with the objective sense, and that objective sense is that which we can perceive first. And so we have the humanly objective as the first one. It comes to us and hits us first. And only when it hits us, then it begins to sink in, and we are able to take it up subjectively in the human consciousness. And as we take it up in subjectively in the human consciousness and take up the divine, in that measure we oust out, in the last column, the wrong sense of God. It is as simple as that, and one just can see categories. So here, for instance, with mind, we have done the exercise with mind, you can see quite a lot already. And naturally it will apply to the other synonymous terms, but I just take it first to see the rhythm and the flow of it and the importance of it. You begin to see something quite interesting. For instance, you see, for instance, that seeking, which is the humanly subjective standpoint, is really a spin-off of the divinely human standpoint. It's not something that is primary. It comes here as the outcome of the divine, subjective, objective consciousness, as the outcome, how it hits the human, and the human has the freedom to take it or to leave it. And if we take it, it begins to seek. So that seeking is not the initial activity of divine seeking. I say that because of what? Because in a religious way, one always says to somebody, well, you must seek God. And you must start by seeking God. Those who seek will find. And we have all those statements that really start off by showing that which is necessary in order to understand God is that we seek God. But that is only metaphysical, that's religious. How on earth can we seek God if we don't know Him? What shall we seek when we don't know Him? What authority will lead us to find if we have no authority but just our desire to seek? Now, you find a completely different standpoint. The moment we take structuralism, look here, how wonderful that is. The moment we take structuralism and have a concept, a problem like seeking, and the whole world knows that seeking is a very important point, and we have a problem like seeking. What did structuralism say? Structuralism said, structuralism makes out of every problem a point of intersection of multivarious system of reference. So we don't take seeking as an atomistic truth and say, all right, seeking leads us anywhere, so let's seek. Let's seek, 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 seek. And all through our life we seek and seek and seek, and perhaps we'll never find. So many people seek and seek and seek. Some find something, and then afterwards when they have found something, they find out that it was the wrong thing that they have found. And so they start seeking again and seeking again and finding something else, until perhaps finally they come to some point where they feel, I have found what really satisfies me. Okay, that's fine. You see, that's the atomistic approach. If we consider seeking structurally, we say, where in the whole chart does seeking appear? We ask for the frame of reference of seeking. And if we know these structures, then we see, for instance, here that seeking is a point of intersection of the word in Christian Science, when it is in the humanly subjective category. See, you can take various system of reference until you corner an atomistic truth, until you find its place value. Here you have the word category intersecting with Christian Science, but that's not enough yet. Within that Christian Science you have the category of the human and the category of the subjective, humanly subjective. Then you find its place value. And what's the use of it? The use of it is that then we know how to start right. Namely, structuralism says, start out with wholeness. With wholeness. Not with a part, not with seeking. Therefore, here we start out with the wholeness of that system of reference, which would be start out with the divinely subjective standpoint where you are aware that mind says, or there the I am says, I am mind. And where you begin to follow it up and see that mind knows itself objectively as the all-knowing mind, as the all-intelligence of mind, as that mind which knows all, sees all, hears all, perceives all, comprehends all, and you get the sense of that infinite information tank of the one mind that knows all, that is all intelligence, and you fill your consciousness with that, still not seeking. You fill your consciousness with that, and as one fills one's consciousness with that, that divinely subjective standpoint has within itself the ability to give vision, to give enlightenment, to reveal itself. Like a lightning comes like that. The Americans make that, Like that, It comes into one's mind and it hits us as vision, and then when we see the vision we say, okay, I begin to seek that vision. I think now along that vision. I'm going to mold my thought according to that vision. I turn now my thought more and more to that vision. And it turns right back again to that vision, to the one intelligence that is embedded in mind. And so you seek mind instead of something else. You seek the nature of mind. You know, the whole textbook is built up that way, that when the textbook speaks not from the argumentative point of view, which it here and there does, but mostly shows really the impact of the divine on the human, then it speaks that way. One of the very first reference in the first chapter on the textbook is mind, and there she speaks in that term. That she says that to mind all thoughts are known. See, to mind all thoughts are known. There is nothing unknown to mind, because mind is all-knowing, all-intelligence. And goes on and says, because it's known to mind, mind will come and so that it will mold our thoughts, mold our thoughts, begins objectively to have an impact on us, will mold our thoughts so that our desires, subjective sense, is purified and exalted, that it may exalt our desires, to exalt our seeking, desire. You could have put here instead of seeking also desire. Yes. So can you see the purpose of structuring the synonymous terms? So that we begin to see that mind can mean all sorts of things. On every level, mind means something else. In every category, mind means something else. And naturally, it still remains mind. Just as, say, if you have a globe on your desk, and the globe is the whole of the earth, but every time you look at it, you see some different aspect. Perhaps you see the North Pole mainly, or you see Australia, New Zealand, or Polynesia, and you don't see the rest. And yet you know, even if you only see an aspect, it's an aspect of the whole. You know that the rest is there too. But it accentuates some part of the whole. And that's what structuralism does. That it, through structuring, you can accentuate the right aspect of the whole. And therefore find also your right place value.